Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But then it puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly was situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not that your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure
to turn the call over to Michael Edwards, and here I am. Ladies and gentlemen, we have some new callers tonight, so I'd like to start with a 30,000-foot overview of what we're doing here tonight and what Mr. Slevin will be sharing with you in great detail. The basic thing to understand is that everything that you think you know about the LLC, the limited liability corporations, no matter how much experience you have with them, you know, hey, I've been doing them all my life. You're not going to be able to tell me anything I don't know. Well, I beg to differ with you. You're going to learn tonight that there is a unique creation of the LLC that is in such a way, it is assembled in such a way that it voids or leaves out any tax liability associated with it. And Mr. Slevin will get into detail with that on that. The thing that I like about it is that Mr. Slevin's product by itself is $7,500. And Bernie, on another information provider we have, Justice Beshear, offers a product called the Golden Horseshoe, which when properly set up it costs you about $35,000 to put together. Well, Mr. Slevin's LLC happens to fit hand in glove with the work that Justice Beshear put together in this Golden Horseshoe. So what we're offering is basically a lead-in for you to enable you to acquire this LLC in preparation for entering it later into the Golden Horseshoe when funds become available. The one thing that you do differently from Mr. Slevin's regular program is that instead of you coming in yourself, creating this LLC or being the direct manager, if you would, of this LLC, you're acquiring two charitable religious trusts, which under themselves are deemed by the IRS as a non-taxpayer, and you are at this moment the trustee to this trust, each of these trusts, so you have total and full control over what the trusts do, and it's those two trusts that each take 50% share in the ownership, if you would, of this LLC. And then then you can just take off and you're running down the road with it. Sometime later, when the business that you're doing is paying off and now you've got more money available to you because you're not having to give it all away or at least 30% of it in taxes and so forth, you can now afford to go into the Golden Horseshoe, which this perfectly plugs into. And so without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin. I also want to let you know that we have John, who is the lead litigator of the team, auditing this call tonight. And so it's just welcome, John. Say hello, everybody. Okay. I've got everybody muted. Nobody can say hello. So without further
sorry, ado, I was pulling a sorry, I was pulling a Michael there. I was muted and I had to find the mute button.
I know.
So there's your payback for the week, Michael.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that. I love dead air. Mr. Slevin, let me turn the call over to you at this time. Oh, one other thing, Mr. Slevin, just so you know, the gentleman that purchased your product last week, his two CRTs were created, the creation was finished today, so I expect you to be talking to you tomorrow about proceeding now with the actual execution of the LLC with him.
Excellent.
Yep.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am sitting here in the Smoky Mountains, and it's wet, cold, and foggy, so we now know why they're called Smoky Mountains. A little history lesson. We'll start off with the place in which the country known as America, for short, stuck its post in the ground and started from. The Declaration of Independence, published July 4th, 1776, and we're in the part which I feel is probably the most quoted, if not the most important, we find, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness," end quote. Now, I would suggest reading the Declaration of Independence every so often in its entirety, because it lays out the egregious nature that the monarchy of England was placing upon what it considered its second-class citizens or colonists. And the other thing that the Declaration is an example of reason. Now, people go, well, what's reason? Reason is being able to move logically from one point to another in order to solve a problem, if you will. Reason is actually ordained by God. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool," end quote. A fantastic visual of setting what is perceived to be wrong and making it right, wouldn't you say? So after we declared our independence from England, the monarchy thereof, and or the sovereignty of that construct, devolved upon we the people. And the most eloquent way of saying that was done in a case called Chisholm v. Georgia from 1793, just shortly after the Constitution. 10 years after the Constitution came about. So from Chisholm, quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence and constantly remind us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such idea obtains here. At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country, but they are sovereigns without subjects, (unless the African slave among us may be called so), close paren. and have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in the sovereignty. So we can plainly see that each American, by virtue of the Declaration and the Revolution and the contest between we the people and Great Britain, each American became a sovereign, a truly free man. In other words, we each own ourselves. Our bodies are entitled to us and to us alone. Therefore, the production of those bodies must also belong to its sovereign consciousness, if you will. However, that freedom or liberty, if you will, also carries great responsibility, whereas the value of entitlement empowers us to make contracts. Those agreements can easily trade away our bodies and our production for mere promises. And if one is not careful, one of these promises is of security. So we must go back to the wise Benjamin Franklin, who once wrote, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety," end quote. So when making contracts at the small or the large, whichever, we must be very wise. As the ancient warrior said, choose wisely when offered the benefit in trade for our birthright. Now, birthrights is something you don't hear very often, but I would suggest that you go down to Genesis 25, verses 29 through 34, and read that story, because Esau, the heir apparent, sold his birthright for a bowl of porridge. And so that's what happens when people disregard the value of things like their right to life, liberty, and property in the pursuit of happiness. So just as an aside, I'd like to take a minute to address the parenthetical comments in Chisholm about African slaves. I said this was 1793. Now, SCOTUS seemed to have left the Negro out in the cold by that thing. But then, and the Constitution itself outlawed slavery in the future, or at least the importation of slaves. But, you know, slavery continued up until the 1860s. But in 1852, I believe it was, the case Dred B. Scott came about. Dred was a black man who had been owned by a army officer and taken back and forth into free and slave states at that time. And he was given a wife, and they had daughters, I believe. And then later on, the master sold off the wife and the daughters. And so Dred sued him for his freedom and the return of his family. So all justices weighed in on this course, and it's the longest Supreme Court case now in history. It's like 250 pages. So if you ever have a night where you can't fall asleep, read that. I guarantee you'll knock out shortly. Anyway, from page 60 at U.S. 479, this is one of the justices, and this has brought in a great definition of slaves. "The above account of slavery and its modifications will be found in the strictest conformity with the institutes of Justinian." Justinian was a 6th century Roman emperor, and the Roman Empire was going out of style, if you will. "Thus, in Book 1, First Title 3rd, it is said, quote, 'The first general division of persons in respect to their rights is into free man and slaves,' end quote. The same title, Section 4, quote, 'Slaves are born such or become so. They are born such of bond women.'" Remember that term. "They become so either by the law of nations, as by capture, or by civil law," in the fifth section. Quote, In the condition of slaves, there is no diversity, but among free persons, there are many. Thus, some are ingenu, or free men, and others are libertini, or freed men. From the fourth, the ingenuous, quote, a free man is one who is born free by being born in matrimony of parents who are both free, or both freed, or of parents one free and the other freed. But one born of a free mother, although the father be a slave or a free, or unknown, is free. So that sets it up. And Roman law penetrates American law in a lot of different ways. So after Dred V. Scott, then we had the War of Northern Aggression, and they came about, after that was finalized, they came about with a 13th Amendment to eliminate slavery. And the 13th Amendment says in Section 1, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall be have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So that removed all bonds from the people of America at that point, whether they were Negro or Chinese or some other similarly situated party. So anybody born after the 13th Amendment's ratification was free by definition in Dred. Oh, I just found this the other day. This, what I just read, the 13th Amendment, is actually the second 13th Amendment. And as early as 2013, the New Hampshire House brought forth a resolution called 638. And this is what it says. Quote, in 1810, a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution, which prohibited titles of nobility and which later became known as the original 13th Amendment, was introduced, passed both houses of Congress, and was sent to the states for ratification. On December 9th, 1812, shortly after ratification by Virginia, New Hampshire became the 13th state to ratify the amendment. The amendment was therefore ratified by the requisite number of states and became Article 13 of the United States Constitution. This article reads, if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, like the title Esquire, or shall without the consent of Congress accept and retain any present pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatsoever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them. Let that sneak in a minute. So had the War of 1812 and the British not burned down Washington, this would have been the 13th Amendment found on all documents. But that's what happened. And some people say that's why it happened, along with a lot of other financial interests, shall we say. So let's move our discussion back to the 1865 version of the 13th Amendment. And we see the outlawing of slavery. And as Justinian said, that any member of mankind born in America, because they're now born of free women, are free. And that's just the situation. Now, then the 14th Amendment came along because it was thought or it was presented that the freed Negroes were not being treated properly and did not have the same rights as white folks in the Confederacy and so forth. So they came up with this 14th Amendment, But what this 14th Amendment did was actually create a second class of citizenship. And the 14th Amendment, and I didn't pick that up. Anyway, it says the something to the effect of any person born or naturalized in the United States is a citizen thereof, lowercase c citizen, which is not the capital KC citizen of the United States of America, which is what we the people were. So the that is a piece of the pie, and then I believe I'll get to something about that in a little bit in a case called Slaughterhouses. Right, so the Constitution of the United States was approved on June 21st, 1788, and then the Bill of Rights came about in 1791, and then Chisholm v. Georgia. So we had the formation of the government of the United States, and it's by the Constitution, it was given 10 miles square, which is now off the Potomac River. And then come along at 1871, there's this thing called the District of Columbia Organic Act. This act of Congress repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown and established a new territorial government for the whole District of Columbia. So what that did, oh, and just in case, some people say that that was also, it was also incorporated around that time. There's various stories on that. But that is backed up by 28 U.S.C. 3002 definitions. As used in this chapter 15, United States means a federal corporation. Okay, so we have this conversion of the original government under the original Constitution to this new thing. And what this act did, in fact, was make District of Columbia a city-state. Now, a city-state, just to give you reference, is the City of London, which is a one-mile square enclave in Greater London of the UK, and Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the center of Rome, Italy, are city-states. They are entirely independent from anything around them or anything else in the world. These three city-states, D.C., City of London, and Vatican, comprise the three rulers of this earth. D.C. is the military, City of London is the financial, and Vatican is the ecumenical power centers. And these folks believe that they own everything and everybody. And you can go back to papal bulls in the 1300s and so forth to find that the Vatican actually wrote that down. So they believe they own everything and everybody, and therefore they will enforce that belief with merciless efficiency. Here's a little evidence that the city-state of District of Columbia, or D.C. for short, really did become a city-state because they started acquiring foreign property. In 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out, and the use of the Pearl Harbor grew to great importance. And if you know anything about history, today is Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. Anyway, so D.C. acquired the islands, the Hawaiian Islands territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple, who had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 U.S. Marines. Now, as a result of the Spanish-American War, D.C. acquired the properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba was supposedly set free, but it was kind of a gangster's hideout, and that's why when the Castro Revolution of the 50s came along, it went in and is still suffering from that awful thing. Now, the Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946, but it's still a mess. And you can, it's just That list of mess is just too long to even go into. Now, Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories of D.C., but there's some rather interesting agencies that have been headquartered out there. One in Puerto Rico is the Internal Revenue Service. Yes, the headquarters of the IRS is in Puerto Rico. And a friend of mine calls it, instead of IRS, he says IRS stands for It's Really Satan. And if you look at how it operates, we have to say that's the truth. Nonetheless, D.C. specifically became a city-state by adopting a constitution. Now, this constitution looks very much like the original one of 1788. But there's one distinct difference. In 1788, it says the Constitution for the United States of America. But in the Constitution that D.C. brought on, it says the Constitution of the United States. And, you know, if you just listen to commentators, typically they always say of. They almost never say for the United States. Now, to just to understand why this difference these little words make, we get this from Wikipedia. Two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an old English preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially came from before, which also means on account of. Now, so if you look at it that way, the city-state of D.C. adopted the Constitution of the United States, which means it is away from or without the Union, known as the several states comprising the United States of America. And now, I've gone through a whole lot of stuff that really sounds like not normal language. And this is because the people that write this stuff just do it in machinations and twistings. And they're known as lexicographers, or lexicos for short, or also known as legislative draftsmen. And these guys are wordsmiths to the nth degree. And but as we know from our military days, if it ain't written down, it didn't happen. So these guys write it down, but they write it in such a horrific way. In fact, the Supreme Court somewhat castigated them in a case called Merchants Loan and Trust v. Simtanka in 1921. At 28, it says, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it believed to be commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to Congress, to the Constitution, rather. So that in itself is doublespeak, if you will. But the court was looking at this and saying and pronouncing itself clairvoyant because they said they know what's in the minds of the people. Nonetheless, okay. So this guy named Flesch, his last name is spelled F L E S C H, came up with an index to measure English language, and so for any this Flesch index goes from 1 to 100. Now, just as an example, a newspaper, typical newspaper you pick up on the street, is written at 8.5. A first-year college student understands about 11. A law school graduate comprehends at nearly 15. The tax code itself is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. Folks, these Bass, B-A-S-S, turds really do not want you to know what's going on. And this is a very good example of that. So when we find ourselves looking at taxing statutes, there's some, in order to be legitimate, they must have three specific things: the subject of the tax, the measure of the tax, and a statement of liability, as in who must pay the tax, because that's the most important part. Because if you don't know you're supposed to pay your tax and some thug comes at you wanting to take your property or your life, you know, how can you defend yourself? So anyway, the Constitution for the United States of America designates the two great classes of taxation. They are direct, which is applied by apportionment, as well as indirect, which must, according to the Constitution, must be uniform throughout the state. Now, I'll just go ahead and run these off real quick. The parts of the Constitution where that comes from are Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debt and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Those are three words meaning indirect taxes. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, no capitation, or head tax, if you will, or any other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Now, this clause basically refers to a tax on property, which such a tax was based on the value of land as well as capitation, which is a head tax and was applied to slaves. So Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5, no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. So you can't tax exports, but you can put an excise tax on imports. Now, by implication, we see that there are three categories of taxables. These are people, property, and activities. Direct taxes are applied to people and property via census, enumeration, and valuation. Indirect taxes, which are most appropriately described as excise in order to keep them straight, so we have direct and excise, are placed on activities. However, there must be a way devised to measure the activity. Now, this has come down through time as calculating the production of said activity or a flat fee on something necessary for the process. To demonstrate the measure of the tax, I often ask, is there an excise tax on whiskey? Everybody goes, oh, sure there is. Well, no. Whiskey is property. It's something you can hold and calculate the measure of. And so if it's property, then it can't be an excise tax. So it can't be on the whiskey, but can the whiskey be a measure of the activity? Yes. But what is the activity? That would be distillation. Now, distillation has been ruled by the powers that be to be a privilege. And there will be, you know, more than one person will dispute that and say, no, that's definitely required for life. So since whiskey is property, then it must be the measure of activity. The activity, so I'll back up here. So in our example, the subject of the tax is a privileged activity of distillation, with the measure being the containers of whiskey, or the other piece of the way that they measure an excise is by placing a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery or whatever is necessary for the production so that it can cover all venues. So, but either way, in this example, we find a little stamp on all the containers of spirits to show that the tax has been paid and that so the revenuers don't come and get you. So the 16th Amendment brings a whole lot of this together, and it says, quote, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. All right. So we've got two types of taxes, direct and excise, right? So direct must be done by apportion. So when the 16th Amendment says that this power to lay and collect taxes on incomes without apportionment, it cannot be a direct tax. Therefore, it must be an excise. And as we stated before, excises are on activity. So what's the activity? Well, we'll get to that. Now, as you can see, the power is to lay an excise tax on incomes, but as income is not an activity, it must therefore be a measure, and the measure of some privileged exercise. And that is what SCOTUS says in Stratton. And, quote, "And however the operation shall be described, the transaction is indubitably, quote, business, end quote, within the fair meaning of the Act of 1909, and the gains derived from it are properly and strictly income from that business. For income may be defined as gain derived from capital or labor, or from both combined, and here we have a combination of capital and labor. As to the alleged inequities of operations between mining corporations and others, it is of course true that the revenues derived from the working of mines result in some extent, to some extent, in the exhaustion of the capital. But the same is true of the earnings of the human brain and hand when unaided by capital. Yet such earnings are commonly dealt with in legislation as income. So it may be said of many manufacturing corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, especially of those that have to do with production of patented articles, although it may be foretold from the beginning that the manufacturer will be profitable only for a limited time, at the end of which the capital value of the plant must be subject to the material depletion, and the annual gains of such corporation are certainly to be taken as income for the purposes of measuring the amount of tax." And then we jump down to 417, and it says, quote, "And the return, the tax return, was to be made under oath by the president and treasurer or other officers having like duties, indicating the clearest manner that it was to set forth data that with the proper accounting would appear upon the books of the corporation." And that's Stratton Independence v. Halbert. So because Congress is barred from taxing anything that sustains our right to life, it has to be a privilege, they place this tax on income on something which must be applied for, and that is, or chartered. And that was relayed in Flint v. Stone Tracy, 1911, from 151. Quote, "The tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon a particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, i.e. with the advantages which arise from corporate or quasi-corporate organization, or when applied to insurance companies for doing business in such companies." And at 152 it says, "If business is not done in the manner described in the statute, no tax is payable." And then jump down to 161, we find, "In the case at bar, we have already discussed the limitations which the Constitution imposes upon the right to levy excise taxes, and it cannot be said, even if the principle of the 14th Amendment were applicable to the present case, there is no substantial difference between carrying on a business by corporate and the same business done by private firms or private individuals. The thing taxed is not the mere dealing in merchandise in which the actual transaction may be the same, whether conducted by individuals or corporations, but the tax is laid upon the privileges which exist in conducting business with the advantages which inhere to the corporate capacity of those taxed, and which is not enjoyed by private firms, partnerships, or individuals." So, what does that all mean? It comes down today in Section 701. "A partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed by this chapter, period." Now, that's the first sentence of 701, and the chapter it refers to is Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is titled Normal Taxes and Surtaxes. The normal tax was coined by Congress in 1913. So They did the 16th Amendment. They wrote the 1909 Revenue Act. Along came Flint v. Stone Tracy and Statton v. Halbert and said, yep, this is a good tax, good constitutional excise tax on carrying on business in the corporate capacity. But private firms and private individuals are not subject to it because they can't partake of the privilege. And so what that did was it allowed Congress to, in 1913, to write the Revenue Act, and they got to use shorthand. So they got to leave off excise, and they got to leave off with respect to carrying on business and so forth. So they just said, okay, there's hereby a tax imposed upon income. And you're supposed to know about Flint v. Stone Tracy because that's the way these lexicographers do things. So this is borne out by the second sentence in Section 701. Persons, quote, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax in their separate or individual capacities. There it is. That is the subject of the tax on income, is carrying on business, income being the measure. It's all there if you have to go back and read it. Of course, all this is coming from the statutes at large, and I often tell people I've probably got two PhDs of reading and studying this thing. So if this is mystifying to you, don't worry. We got it covered. So the lexicographers and the draftsmen, the legislative draftsmen, go by what's called rules of construction, all right? And one of the rules of construction is that if there's a if the legislature defines a specific word or phrase in the statute, one must use that definition when reading the section it applies to. So just to give you a little understanding of that, the 701 talks about a partnership. But partnership is actually a defined term way over in 7701. And the other piece of the pie that was defined or was used in that thing was person. So we go over to 7701A1, person. Listen to this carefully. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company or corporation. Then we see in part two, or in A, at A2, the term partnership in part says the term partnership includes an A, unincorporated organization. And then there's one you really like if you want to go over to 7701A20 is employee. Now this is, but it goes back to the original stuff in the 19-teens and 09 and so forth. Said A20 employee, for the purposes of applying the provisions of Section 79 with respect to, and it goes on for about another 109 words, and it says the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman who is considered to be an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21. Now, Chapter 21 is where FICA is considered. So all you people out there that thought you've been an employee all this time, nope, unless you're a full-time life insurance salesman, okay? Make sure you get that down and tell your boss about that. So FICA, or the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, started out in the Social Security Act of 1935. This is where we tie together what was done back in the 1909, 10, and 13, and so forth. Now, the Social Security Act of 1935 was created in 11 separate titles, and that was done by FDR, who knew full well that the act was unconstitutional. The reasoning was that by doing it in 11 titles to keep at least something of the socialist agenda alive, because FDR knew that doing it this way, if one title fell, the others would stand. Now, the benefit portion, and I suggest you read the whole of the Social Security Act as well, because it's a masterful work in camouflage. So the old age benefit was in Title II. It reads, Title II Federal Old Age Benefits Old Age Reserve Account, Section 201A. There is hereby created an account in the Treasury of the United States to be known as the Old Age Reserve Account, herein in this title called the account. Reserve is another word for escrow. If you read down through the rest of Title II, it talks about that this escrow account is for the payment of old age benefits to certain qualified individuals. Its funding is at the discretion of the Secretary of Treasury. And if any money is in the account that is not to, is in the Secretary of Treasury's estimation is not going to be used in the next year, then it must be invested. Long story short, what this did was build an account. It's not your account. It's the United States' account. It's in their treasury, and it is invested in by foreign people. I have a link that can you can go to and put in your Social Security number and see how many people have invested in that escrow account over time and how big the investments are. Now, a lot of them are from Western Europe, but we have some here in the States as well. So, so this is going to a qualified individual, all right? And also in Title II, I believe it says there will be no citizenship test laid upon qualified individuals. You can explore that on your own. So the funding for this is done by taxation, and it says, and this was over in Title VIII, which says taxes with respect to employment. Now, remember back in the 1909 Revenue Act, we said that it was upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity? Section 801, quote, in addition to other taxes, there shall be levied, collected, and paid upon the income of every individual a tax equal to the following percentages of the wages received by him after December 31, 1936, comma, with respect to employment. So, okay, yeah, I'm in employment, right? Because I work for somebody. Nope, not even. So, Title 11, they show their hand. And it says at Section 1101A6, quote, the term employee includes an officer of a corporation, period, end quote. Well, yeah, but that includes, right? That means that includes the janitors and the clerks and the machine operators and so forth. Nope. Remember the definition in the rules of construction? What it, if they define a term or a phrase, it must be used, that definition must be used. And at 1101B of Title 11 of the Social Security Act, it says, quote, the terms includes and including when used in a definition contained in this act shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of the term defined, end quote. Is that a word salad or what? And that comes forward today in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 701C, it says, includes and including. The terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the term defined. If you do a sentence diagram on either of those, you come up with about three sets of double negatives. So a double negative in a sentence cancels it out. And so if we do that and diagram it, this is what we're left with. The terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained herein, shall be deemed to encompass only the things listed in the term defined, end quote. Does that sound better? So therefore, the only employee, according to the Social Security Act, is the officer of a corporation. But remember, we read the employee definition about the full-time life insurance salesman. Both of those corporations and quasi-corporations were mentioned in the earlier court cases that I read. Okay, I'm pretty sure you're all probably tired of hearing about all this background, but this is why, the reason why I had to bring that forward is to show you how our company makes our clients more successful than they've ever been. So our company creates a situation in which our clients can keep all they earn. I'd like to mention that the limited liability companies were first legislated in 1977. The various state governments took out the best parts of corporations and partnerships, which had been around for centuries, to create this new thing. Here again, I want to remind everyone that these LLCs fall under the definition of partnership, which shall not be subject to the income tax imposed. All right, so how do we do this? Well, one of our people will, once we agree on a name with a client, one of our people goes down to the Secretary of State of New Mexico, this is digitally, of course, and they apply to organize a limited liability company. That application is called the Articles of Organization, and in New Mexico, it requires a minimum of two parties. Both, they are the parties, the parties are organizer and registered agent, but both of these parties can be other LLCs. So our organization, our company, has a sister company, and one of us works as the organizer, and the other works as the registered agent on the paperwork. So you can probably see how this can be really nice in a layering approach and makes a great privacy shield. But unlike Delaware, Nevada, and possibly Wyoming, where when people and make application to incorporate or organize, there must be humans on that list. And that is referred to in some places as the nominee list. Now, these states protect the list. Delaware and Nevada particularly are famous for that. But guess what? In New Mexico, the list does not exist. That which does not exist cannot be found. So great privacy. So New Mexico... The Secretary of State of New Mexico then provides our folks with a certificate of organization, and we'll use it for our example. This is New Company LLC. So that comes into the office, and then one of our other workers who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return makes application to the IRS to get a tax identification number for New Company LLC. Now, that tax identification number is known as an employer identification number, or EIN. And when he or she goes and does that, they ask a question. It says, why is the LLC requesting an EIN? And they give you five choices. The middle one, we don't even worry about the rest of them, but the middle one is great. It's why we use it. It's called banking purposes. And it says in the subheading, select this option if the reason for applying for an EIN is strictly to satisfy requirements or local law, period. Do you hear anything about taxes? No, because LLCs are not subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, Chapter 1, or anything else for that matter. Now, upon receiving the EIN, the individual which had made the application on the IRS paperwork is shown as the sole member of, in our example, New Company LLC. That sole member then holds a meeting of the company, and at the meeting, he or she makes a resolution commissioning a third party as the manager of New Company LLC. Now, manager is the only officer known to the LLC, where corporations have president, CFO, directors, and such, and partnerships have limited partners and general partners, manager is the only officer in LLC, but the company can have as many managers as they wish, and they can put any kind of words in front of a manager like chief executive or whatever. So, but this is all done by a vote of the members. Now, the members, instead of having shares, they have percentages of membership. However, that can also be taken, that does not limit it to 100, because you can take down these percentages of membership down to the fourth or fifth decimal place and basically can have the company or is allowed them to have as many different members as it wishes. So the manager now has a commission, and he takes that commission, the certificate of organization and the EIN papers down to a bank, and gets New Company LLC a checking account. Once that's accomplished, the manager brings it all back to the office, and the staff pairs a pay-as-you-go cell phone with the company. Now, this phone is programmed with electronic banking, and we like to include Square App and Cash App because Square and Cash are point-of-sale and peer-to-peer platforms, extremely useful. And guess what? It all goes back to the LLC and not the people actually pushing the buttons on the application. So we put this all together, put the money in there, shape it all up, make sure everything works, and we ship New Company LLC, in our example, to the client. Once the client opens this business in a box, they become equipped to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. What are your questions?
My first question is, what would be the mechanics of bringing in, say, PayPal?
Would you mind repeating that?
What would be the mechanics to bring in, say, PayPal as a service provider or bring on additional providers like PayPal? Glorify is one. Gab App is another. Gab Pay.
The exact same thing that I just described. So
okay.
The pay-as-you-go cell phone that we're providing is pay-as-you-go. It's not linked to anybody. You know, it's a cash phone, if you will.
Okay.
So that phone is not the only phone it's not the only device that can be used with our product. That's just the one we provide so that it's ready to go out of the box. You can get your laptop, your tablet, or whatever else all hooked up and so that they can be the terminals for the various applications. So just like we assist in getting the Cash App and the Square App and whatever, and there's another one out there, Bluevine, and multiple others. But just like we do the applications for that, then we assist the client in bringing in whatever their business requires. You know, this is a base model. This is, you know, we know this piece of it works. Now, it's also known as a business model, okay? And what you do now, or what the client does now, is their business model. And so we bring this brand new, great new thing that's totally independent of anybody else's circumstances. It is a new business model, and and any business done under that umbrella is income tax free. So now we have two things. So we want to integrate them. This integration can be very little or very much depending on the client's situation. So we can get into all those details. But if the client wants the new company to be paid via PayPal, then you make application to PayPal and whatever their policy is, we supply the answers to the questions. Does that make sense?
Okay, great. So bringing PayPal in still comes through your organization.
No, what we like to do is when we transfer off the business to the client, we say, hey, look, this is now your business, all right? And so we will assist, and oh, by the way, we never advise on anything, neither tax advice or love advice or anything like that. No advising. We simply make suggestions to the client or persons on the other end of the phone of what we believe are beneficial activities as if we were similarly situated, as you like.
Sure.
So, I just want to reiterate that. What?
Great. Our first question comes from Guy. Go ahead, Guy.
Good evening, man. How are we doing? Thank you for taking the phone call. Thank you very much. I have two questions. One question is, how does this new business structure will still be liable for the state tax and workers' comp? The second question.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Let's stick to one question at a time because I get confused easy. Okay. So did you say state or estate?
I'm sorry, state, just like state of Montana, state of Maine, New York.
So that would be the state income tax?
Yes, I believe so. I'm trying to have my mind cover all bases thinking of this.
Now, I understand it, but I'm a stickler on technology, or excuse me, I'm a stickler on terminology, and I try not to ever use pronouns. Some of our woke friends are always talking about, because that makes for confusion. And in this venue, being precise is where it's at. So a New Mexico LLC is not subject to the income tax, federal or state. All right. Because the state income taxes among the several states they're the same thing as the federal one. They just write it in a bunch of superfluous words. All right. So what's the other tax that you were asking about?
Well, I mean, the question I have is not saying anything bad about New Mexico, but not being from Mexico and not really planning to move to New Mexico, I would like to have my future business be able to do business like in the state of New York, for example, or the state of Maine or Florida.
Sure. Did you catch my comment about doing business worldwide?
Yes, I did hear part of that.
Okay, so that is true. Okay. The entity called Limited Liability Company, organized in the state of New Mexico, is a domestic LLC in that state. All right. When it goes to, say, New York in your example, New York looks at it as a foreign LLC, and it therefore has some properties that is normally usually followed for a foreign LLC transacting business within the state of New York. However, the reporting mechanism is via the income tax. So if you acquired one of our products and went to New York and started doing business, you know, you were selling widgets or washing cars or whatever, then there would not be any reporting done by third parties to the state of New York, and therefore there's no, they wouldn't know you were there, because third party reporting, and let me just cover this real quick. In the income tax world, third party, the IRS considers itself the first party, and you lowly taxpayers are the second party. And then the people that hand the lowly taxpayer money are known as the third party. And this money is considered income, which the definition of income is revenue minus deductions. But as we know from our early example, income is simply the measure, and the privilege is doing business in the corporate capacity. That's what it is. And I hope that earlier explanation lay that out in specific detail. So that's how you would go and do business with our product in some foreign jurisdiction, being foreign to New Mexico, and still be successful.
Okay.
And there's a lot of details involved in that, but
yeah,
sure. That's the basis of it. Okay,
but the second question then would be, let's say, you know, my employee will be asking for, well, I need to have my 1099 or my W-4 at the end of the year so I can pay my taxes. Well, hopefully I will be able to get the same number.
So just, I'm going to make an example, and if it's not what you're thinking about, let me know. So we'll use the one we used in our example. New company LLC is purchased by you, and you go in to do in New York, and you're just doing business, and you have people working for new company. All right.
Okay.
We don't use the word employee, because employee is defined several places, as I mentioned, within the Internal Revenue Code. So these are workers and or performers are two words that make a good use of. So the worker is doing whatever he does, and you pay him. And new company LLC pays that worker. At the end of the year, this is real, at the beginning of the relationship between the worker and new company LLC, new company's personnel or managers will explain to the worker, look, I want you to do this service, and for this service, I'm going to hand you this much cash. Any taxes that you may think that you're responsible for are your responsibility. Yep. And
okay. That's
it. I mean, you know, there may be some other things to be covered, but that's the basis of it, because it is a strictly an upfront. There's no hidden fees or anything like that. So it's strictly an upfront or honest.
In my opinion, you look at that as like a subcontractor of a particular bid. You know, the general gets the bid and subcontracts the work out. Here's the money for doing this part of the job.
Yep.
Do with that money with what you see fit. And that's how this money trickles down. I see now how
that's,
that
yeah, that's the way it that's the way it rolls. Exactly.
Okay.
And here again we're as we talked about, you know, we're all sovereign, right? Except mm-hmm. for the people that have been snookered. And I believe it's GW has the answer for that, to go from the DC slave back to the original sovereign we the people status. So okay.
Great.
So yeah. Any other questions?
No, sir. Thank you so much. It's cleared up so much for me, man. I'm very excited. It's exactly what I want.
Thank you. Good.
Excellent. Thank
you. And the thing is, it can operate in, you know, for if someone's an employee, they work for Walmart, let's say. I'm just making up stuff here. Mm-hmm. They can create this LLC and then ask Mr. Slevin, and he will assist you in communicating with HR or Walmart or, you know, whoever handles the hiring and the classification that is being done, to show them how they will pay out less than what they're paying now
mm-hmm.
for you as employees by hiring you LLC to do the same thing.
What I really, really enjoy about this product that Michael's explaining is that this is giving us workers now a chance to have a taste of what it's like to be a boss. Right?
Exactly.
You know, you use the word more powerful than you realize. You didn't use the word employee. You used the word worker. I'm proud of you for that.
I'm learning.
Do you offer a workers' agreement?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Are you questioning Herr Slevin?
I'm asking Herr Slevin if he has for people that want to work for someone a workers' agreement.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yes. There, okay. Let me give you the situation as we see it. Have you ever heard of a thing called the burden rate?
No, I have not.
No? Okay. All right. So to put it in ease of use, the burden rate is the bottom line cost to the, and we'll use employer and employee for ease of use. So burden rate calculates the bottom line cost to the employer for the employee's services. It is typically about 1.5 to 1.6 the amount of the work of the employee's salary. So we'll use some round numbers here. So Joe is working for IBM, and Joe is being paid $100,000 a year to do what he does, whether he fixes computers or mops the floor or whatever. So Joe finds out about all the stuff we've just been talking about and acquires an LLC. He then goes, and we'll use new company. So he then goes to his boss and says, hey, look, boss, I know that my services cost IBM $160,000 a year. So what I'd like to offer you is we're going to take my name off of the employee contract, and we're going to situate new company in that place. So the bottom line is that IBM will once a month cut a check to new company for $10,000. What that means at the end of the year is that all that paperwork that you have normally have to do for me, you don't have to do it anymore. You do one 1099 for $120,000, and it has new company's name and numbers on it. So new company will facilitate any tax burden or whatever else that you've been taking care of. So instead of paying $160,000 a year for my services, you pay $120,000 a year, way less paperwork, and you still get the great job that I'm doing, reporting at the same place at the same time with the same boss. All that stuff is exactly the same. The only thing difference is the paperwork and how much you have to pay out. So that's about, 25% decrease in expenditures? Mm-hmm. You show me a boss that wouldn't love to go to his people and say, hey, how would you like to cut your labor costs by 25%?
Right.
That's the way we negotiate. Make it all about win-win. And okay, now Joe's making 120 now instead of 100. Not a bad raise.
You know, it's just a thought occurred to me, Mr. Slevin, that if you had a company that was, excited about saving 25%, they would easily offer immediately, $7,500 or in this case, $9,500 per employee of theirs to reduce their workforce, their employee workforce, to nothing but dealing with corporate LLCs and getting their work done.
Yep. That makes the most sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That does.
All right. Anyone else have a question? Are you finished, Guy?
Yes, sir, I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Anyone else have a question, press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press *2. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see on the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Underneath that rectangle is a place to put your name, other contact information if you like, and then inside that little box, type away your comment or question and hit submit. I'll be glad to give voice to that. So we have another question here is from Ron in Cocoa, Florida, and then I'll go check Freedoms Radio while he's talking to you.
Coca-Cola tastes very good.
Coca-Cola. Did you hear that Elon Musk is buying Coca-Cola?
No,
I didn't.
Yeah, he's going to buy Coca-Cola, and he pledges to put cocaine, the original recipe, in it.
I wouldn't doubt it. Go ahead.
My question is, who picks up the insurance and workman's comp? Is that through the LLC or is that on an individual basis?
The LLCs that we create, and all LLCs for that matter, are a distinct, independent legal identity from either its manager or members. All right? So in whatever contract, whether it be employment or simple straight contact for services rendered for cash, there are some requirements from the contracting or the person that is initiating a contract, whether that be a business or government or whatever. All right. Most of the insurances are set up to cover people that are deemed dependent, which are employees. So as we all are sovereign or shall soon be sovereign, then you are responsible for yourself. So now in the negotiations with the various entities in the world between our LLCs and that, we run into multiple questions like this. And so we just assist in the negotiation of what the contractor may be required by the contractee to provide. I know that sounds verbose, but that's the overall comment. Because, see, business is all about contracts.
and all business and all contracts are negotiable. It's just a matter of coming upon the wisdom to provide what the guy holding the money wants to get done. And we have success in doing that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. It sounds like the LLC will out of pocket pay for the workman's comp and or any insurance is required.
That would be one way of doing it, yes.
That clarifies. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank everyone for tonight's call. I'm just going to check one more time if we have any other questions here. Let me check Freedom's Radio just to be sure. Dun, 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 dun. Come on, wake up. Wakey, wakey. There we go. Nobody there asking questions. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. Those great questions that were asked. Mr. Slevin, I want to thank you for the time that you put forward. Hopefully from the two gentlemen that asked questions tonight, we may have some more business for you. I know that the pharmacologist that we talked to or that you are doing this work with, he's eager and excited to get moving on it.
Excellent.
All right. So thank you all for joining us this evening. Until next week, good night, everyone. And be
good
well.
Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.